ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 13th of October. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. It's expected all living Israeli hostages taken in the October the 7th attack 2 years ago will be released within the next 24 hours. The United States President Donald Trump is flying to Israel to greet them. The hostages will be exchanged for about 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees as part of the peace plan brokered by Mr. Trump. Correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
At the beach in Tel Aviv, life appears disconcertingly normal. But here, like everywhere in Israel, there were posters of those snatched by marauding Hamas gunmen on October the 7th, 2023. Now 20 remaining living hostages and the remains of 28 who are dead are due to be returned. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it will be a historic day, but he says the campaign is not over yet. Some of our enemies are trying to recover in order to attack us again. And as they say here, we're on it. If the handover goes to plan, up to 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees will be released. Israeli government spokeswoman Shos Badrossian.
Palestinian prisoners will be released once Israel has confirmation that all of our hostages are across the border into Israel.
In Gaza, the ceasefire is holding, but life here is not at all normal. As a convoy of aid trucks made its way through scenes of utter devastation, it was swarmed by large groups of Palestinians desperate to secure some supplies. Mahmoud Abbas Sharia is from Gaza City.
We returned yesterday and found the house destroyed. There are no necessities of life here. No water, no food, no drink.
Donald Trump is not due to visit Gaza. On a brief trip to Israel, the US president will likely receive a hero's welcome. But some people are deeply unhappy about any prospect of peace with the Palestinians.
We want to live in Gaza. We believe that Gaza is a part of the state of Israel.
Hadar Barchai is a settler with the Nahala movement, which for the past week has set up camp close to the Gaza border.
What should happen to the Gazans?
They can go. I expect all the world to open their doors to these people.
The peace plan, though, as you know, that has now been agreed by Israel and Hamas and the US, says that the Gazans should be able to live there. It doesn't talk about them leaving.
I think it's a mistake. It's a mistake.
Views like these are supported by some members of Benjamin Netanyahu's governing coalition. Bringing the hostages home has taken 2 years, but that could be the easy part. This is Barbara Miller in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
The ABC's Four Corners program has investigated how cryptocurrency is helping supercharge the wealth of the US President Donald Trump's family. A former top advisor at the US financial regulator says crypto companies that were pursued by the regulator under the Biden administration are now being embraced by businesses connected to Mr. Trump and his family. The ABC's Americas editor John Lyons has more.
For years, Donald Trump was not just skeptical about cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin, he was hostile.
Bitcoin, it just seems like a scam. I don't like it because it's another currency competing against the dollar.
Now, all that has changed. Four Corners has investigated how crypto is now helping supercharge the Trump family's wealth. During the Biden administration, Corey Freyer was a senior advisor on crypto to the then chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Gary Gensler.
We tried to work with the crypto industry to bring them in, to do the things we would expect of any other financial industry, and they refused over and over again. And so we became very aggressive about enforcing the law.
But that aggression angered Donald Trump. The then presidential candidate promised he would fire the chair of the SEC if re-elected.
On day one, I will fire Gary Gensler and appoint a new SEC chairman. From now on, the rules will be written by people who love your industry, not hate your industry.
Gary Gensler, in fact, stepped down on the day of Donald Trump's inauguration. He was replaced by a Trump appointee who is a crypto advocate. Corey Freyer says some that were once being prosecuted are now being embraced by the Trump family.
We have seen crypto companies that were being prosecuted under the last administration are now essentially receiving lenience.
The White House rejects any improper conduct. The president is exempt from a US federal financial conflicts of interest law. President Trump told Four Corners he did not know how much wealthier he was now than when he returned to the Oval Office and that he'd step back from the businesses. When Four Corners asked President Trump whether it was appropriate for him to be engaged in as much business activity as he was, this was his response.
Where are you from?
I'm from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, okay. Four Corners Program.
The Australians, you're hurting Australia right. In my opinion, you are hurting Australia very much right now. But they want to get along with me. You know, your leader is coming over to see me very soon.
But President
I'm
Trump,
going to tell him about you. You set a very bad tone.
Well,
go
President
ahead,
Trump, okay, when the UAE does a deal does a deal, what does it want in return?
Quiet.
This is John Lyons in Washington reporting for AM.
You can see John's report, Chasing Trump's Billions, on Four Corners tonight, ABC TV at 8:30, or any time on ABC's iView. Cybersecurity experts say it's going to become harder for us to avoid becoming victims of online attacks and phishing scams. That warning follows hackers releasing the details of more than 5 million Qantas customers on the dark web over the weekend. Security specialists say we all need to be more careful as hackers use information like that and artificial intelligence to try and access our bank accounts and impersonate us online. Adam Langenberg reports.
After ransom demands weren't met, hackers have now released the details of more than 5.5 million Qantas customers on the dark web. Those affected by the leak include some frequent flying politicians, like Federal Infrastructure Minister Catherine King.
My data has been subject to that as well as a Qantas user as well.
Qantas says no credit card details were caught up in the hack. And for most customers, the hackers just got their name, email address and frequent flyer details. But for some, their date of birth, address, phone number and gender were also released.
Cyber criminals will use this information. They'll match it to information from other data breaches to form a picture of an individual.
That's Monash University cybersecurity professor Nigel Fair.
It's really difficult for people to be alert and to pick up on these phishing attacks because they're getting much more sophisticated the more information that criminals have about us.
Aaron Bugle from cybersecurity firm Sophos says people need to be mindful when they get an email or a text from a company, especially when they're not expecting it.
Digest them, take a moment, take a breath, and then maybe perhaps validate them using a trusted source. So going off to your bank or actually finding legitimate contact details of your airline carrier and then contacting them to ask them what's up.
The hackers behind the data breach are a collective called Scattered Lapses Hunters. They stole the data of 40 companies, including Qantas, after targeting customers of cloud technology giant Salesforce in July. On Saturday, they published the Qantas data after a ransom wasn't paid, and in a post on their Telegram channel, threatened to relentlessly target Australia unless the country started paying ransoms.
I don't think you should pay ransom under just about any circumstance.
That's Professor Nigel Fair again.
You're dealing with cyber criminals here. Just because they say that if you pay, they won't release the data has not held up to be true in the past. I think Qantas have done the right thing by not paying.
Aaron Bugle agrees, but says complying with the hackers' demands can sometimes be the only way out for businesses in the middle of a crisis.
If that data is the only copy of the data that the hackers now have that will enable that business to operate, it leaves that organisation in a very tricky position on whether or not they do or don't pay.
In a statement, Attorney General Michelle Rowland said the government has already taken steps to improve the nation's privacy laws, including giving the Australian Information Commission more powers and increasing the penalties for companies that fail to take adequate care of customer data. The Australian Information Commission wouldn't say whether Qantas would be fined over the breach, but Professor Fair says there needs to be consequences.
We need a combination of carrot and stick. We need to encourage organisations to have good, safe and secure practices. But for when there are issues like this, they need to pull the stick out because without that, you're not going to get a lot of organisations treating their information security obligations seriously enough.
Salesforce says there is no indication its platform has been compromised.
Adam Langenberg. Here's an awkward question for Western Sydney University. Why is it spending nearly $3,000 a day on individual consultants while it's axing up to 400 jobs? A Senate inquiry into university governance is exploring that, and it's heard the sector is spending nearly $750 million a year on consultants. National Education reporter Connor Duffy has the story.
At Western Sydney University, the invoices speak for themselves. At least seven consultants being paid on daily rates, starting at more than $1,000 a day. One consultant getting $85,000 for 5 weeks' work, plus rebates for tolls and parking. David Birchall is the organiser of the National Tertiary Education Union on campus and says it's a symptom of a larger problem with the use of consultants on campus.
It's a problem because, first of all, these folks, as far as I'm aware, aren't officers of the university. The issue is that people who should be outside giving advice are not giving advice. They're on the inside executing their own advice.
One invoice seen by the ABC shows one consultant is being paid $10,000 a week as the university enacts a change management process that will mean up to 400 voluntary redundancies to stem a looming financial deficit.
It's the most chaotic change process I've ever seen, and that makes people scared. It also makes some people very, very angry.
Faculty student rep Bailey Anderson says students are concerned about how their fees are being spent.
But what we're seeing is a massive focus on profit and not keeping the place sustainable, but keeping the place profitable, which is very different.
It comes amid rising concerns about the use of consultants on university campuses, with some members of the Big Four firms even sitting on university boards. A Senate inquiry into university governance has heard estimates the university sector spends at least $734 million a year on consultants. Universities Australia Chief Executive Luke Shea defends the use of consultants, saying they're used for things like IT security and adhering to regulations.
University management draw on consultancies in a very small way, commensurate or proportionate to their overall budgets. We're working with the government as we have representation on the expert council on governance to ensure that there are principles to have modern governance practice in our universities. But that doesn't address the main issue of funding and ensuring the financial sustainability of our university system.
In a statement, Western Sydney University says the consultant charging $10,000 a week is backfilling pending recruitment and it has significantly reduced its use of outside firms.
Connor Duffy reporting. Tens of thousands of school students don't have access to the technology they need to learn alongside other kids. It's National Poverty Week. The Smith family's highlighting the digital divide. And Australia endures the cost of living crisis, it's asking us, that is the Smith family, to donate used digital devices to charities. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
We're living in the digital age, but technology doesn't come cheap. Mum of four, Belinda Finlay, recalls how difficult it was during the pandemic.
The girls needed digital devices to do their homework with, which at that point we didn't have.
Instead, Belinda and her husband were paying for data on their phones, which became the devices their girls used to complete schoolwork. It was so costly, they struggled to pay their power bills on time.
I felt like a failure. I literally felt like a failure as a mum that I couldn't accommodate what my girls needed. And I was so praying every night that I could maybe win a laptop.
Eventually, one of her daughters was able to get a laptop on a higher program through school, but that one device was being shared between three sisters and Belinda, who was using it to complete her Certificate 3 in business. Belinda and her family have had a long association with the Smith family, which has offered support where possible. Midway through this year, they provided a laptop for Belinda's youngest daughter, Mackay.
The weight's lifted off my shoulders. I have no more stress in worrying that my children don't have that digital support. I am forever, forever in their awe.
Close to 72,000 students are being supported by the Smith family across the country through its Learning for Life education program. But the Smith family says around 40% of those don't have access to a laptop or tablet at home. Doug Taylor is the CEO.
Unfortunately, if we look across secondary schools in Australia today, there are 400,000 young people that don't have access to a digitally connected device. That means that they miss out on making the most of their education. But it's also really important for building digital skills for the future.
The Smith family is working to address this digital poverty divide across the country and is calling on businesses and government to better support the National Device Bank, which collects and refurbishes pre-owned devices, providing them to community organisations, charities and schools to distribute.
A young person that doesn't have access to a digitally connected device runs the risk of being left behind in being able to make the most of their education, but also accessing new types of technologies like AI.
Associate Professor Megan Adams is an education expert from Monash University. She says traditional education has evolved significantly over the decades, both through delivery and learning outcomes, including digital literacy.
I'd say that digital technology has become embedded in contemporary education from early childhood through to university, and there's actually a real push for lifelong learning.
She says a number of actions can be taken to help bridge the digital divide.
We need equitable funding models to ensure schools in low-income, rural and remote areas receive targeted funding for digital infrastructure. We also need universal access to the internet, so investment in reliable high-speed internet for all communities.
The federal government is providing around 30,000 families free internet until mid-2028 through its school student broadband initiative.
Tanya Dendrinos. The Shire of East Pilbara in Western Australia's north is crisscrossed by more than 3,000 kilometres of dusty, unsealed roads connecting towns, remote communities, cattle stations and mine sites. But 8 months on from a Category 4 cyclone, Australia's largest local government area is still struggling to make repairs as the looming wet season's putting isolated residents at risk of being cut off. Alastair Bates reports.
It takes 2 days to drive across Australia's largest shire, east to west. The journey is far from easy.
Year after year, the roads are getting worse and worse, and we've got trucks that are just rattling to pieces. We're struggling to run businesses out here on these roads that are deteriorating so rapidly.
That's Lance Coppen, a Pilbara pastoralist whose station is 70 kilometres from the nearest town. This region of northern WA was lashed by tropical cyclone Zelia back in February. The storm made landfall as a Category 4 system, flooding rivers to record levels and taking whole sections of road with it. 8 months on, spine and suspension rattling corrugations make driving treacherous for even the most formidable of four-wheel drives, and 10 roads remain closed due to flood damage. Lance Coppen says the problem dates back to before the cyclone.
Our issue is with the grading maintenance program that has been gradually depleting and gradually falling away and basically abandoned over the last 4 to 5 years.
President Anthony Middleton says his fleet of road graders isn't enough to maintain the more than 3,200 kilometres of unsealed roads that wind through the outback like arteries.
Some investigation that has been completed over 12 months ago was it's estimated $200 million to do resheet all our roads to an acceptable standard. That's prior to obviously Cyclone Zelia coming through in February. That created an extra $60 million worth of damage.
Many of the roads are trafficked by multi-trailer road trains carting colossal mining equipment and tons upon tons of precious iron ore. Truck driver Michael King says the mining companies, which generate more than $48 billion of the Shire's total economic output, need to do more to preserve the roads.
We've got people out there pounding it to living death. There's nothing left of it, really.
With cyclone repairs stalling and yet another severe weather season bearing down, the Shire is pleading for the state and federal governments to convene a roundtable discussion about road planning and recovery before people are totally cut off. It's attracted the ire of WA Greens MLC Sophie McNeil, who travelled through the region last week.
When you're going out to a remote community, the roads are just atrocious. I mean, the road is a lifeline. And we know that in a warming climate, we're only going to be getting more cyclones like this in WA's north. So we really need that resilience built into our road infrastructure.
The East Pilbara was granted $3 million in funds from the Regional Roads Group a year ago, before Cyclone Zelia hit. WA Minister for Emergency Services Paul Papalia told the ABC there is an obligation on local governments to ensure the roads are up to scratch. But with no confirmation of the proposed roundtable, the ride ahead looks bumpy.
Alastair Bates there, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
How much wealthier is Donald Trump since returning to the White House at the start of the year? That's a question the ABC's America's editor, John Lyons, posed to the president last month, and Trump didn't like it. Today, John Lyons on his Four Corners investigation into Donald Trump's business dealings. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.